Okay, good morning, all.
Good morning.
Oh.
That was a nice response. So first of all, I'd just like to thank my mother, Rachel Winston, for sponsoring this morning. It's sponsored for the refuah of Reisha Esther Bas Rachel and Shoshana Rachel Bas Ita Fagel. We pray that they should make a speedy recovery very soon. So as we begin to talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik, so what's just a few words of introduction, kind of as a stark contrast to our class last month when we spoke about Rav Kook. So Rav Kook is fascinating for our community to learn about and to hear a little bit about because it's a name that we've heard for most of our lives, but most of us probably can't actually say give over much of the teachings or even much of the biography of Rav Kook. So that's what's so exciting about him, because he is like this exciting name that we've heard, but not that much is known by the average American consumer, if you will. But when it comes to the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he is our Rav, right? We call him colloquially the Rav. He's all of our rabbis, whether or not people in this room heard him teach directly, right? He has not been gone for so long, only about 25 years. This year will be the 26th year since he's been gone. And every single rabbi, just about, certainly in North America, but really around the world nowadays, in some way, shape, or form, was educated by him. So many people were educated by him, but I venture to say, I don't know the exact statistics, but since the majority of the rabbis in the world, probably in shuls, I think the majority of rabbis are YU rabbis, and that means that either they were educated by the Rav or they were educated by people who were educated by the Rav. So most of Orthodox Judaism that we know nowadays, certainly in our communities, is because of the teachings and the leadership of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So he really is our rabbi, whether, again, it was our direct rabbi or our rabbi's rabbi. He really was and still continues to be the leader of our community, even posthumously. And we'll see, actually, fascinating, that towards the end of our class, that the person that he is remembered as may or may not be the person that he was when he was alive, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But let's just get started. So the Rav obviously is known by many as the father of modern Orthodoxy. We'll speak a little bit about later the fact that he's known as the father of modern Orthodoxy, but if you would have asked him if he was a modern Orthodox Jew, unclear if he would have actually agreed or had said that himself, but that is certainly how he is remembered. So what is his life all about? So Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, or Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, was born on February 27th, 1903, on the 12th of Adar, in 5663. And he was born in Pruzhana, which was then Russia, but is now part of Belarus. Rabbi Soloveitchik's family tree can be found on source number one on the first page over here, just to get a sense of who Rabbi Soloveitchik was and his family was. Some of us may already know this, but just certainly worthwhile as a review. So if you go all the way turn it sideways, obviously. So if you go all the way on the left side, so going back a few generations, his great grandfather was Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi. That was obviously his namesake. His son was then Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Chaim Brisker, who had another son, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who then obviously was the father of our Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you could see in the family tree over here, he had three kids, two daughters, and one son, Tova Soloveitchik, Atara Soloveitchik, and Chaim Soloveitchik. Those were his three kids. Going back to thinking about the Rav's parents and who they were, so Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who really was an incredibly important figure, certainly even in American Jewish history, in his own right, he preceded our Rabbi Soloveitchik in YU. He was there first, and then the Rav took over for him after his father's passing. But obviously, Moshe Soloveitchik was an incredibly important person. He shares the same legacy with his son. The Rav's great-grandfather, as we said, was the Beis Halevi. His great-great-grandfather was the Netziv. His great-great-great-great, I had to write that down, how many greats? Four greats. Grandfather was Reb Chaim Balazhin, who obviously was a Talmud of the Gra. So his legacy is very clear, that, you know, you go back to talk about serious Torah learning, the most serious Torah that came out of Europe in the past several hundred years was all based on the legacy of the Rav, going back all the way to the Gra, the Vilna Gaon. That was his father's side. His mother's side, his mother's name was Pesia Feinstein. Obviously, we know the name Feinstein very well because of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was clearly a very large American rabbi and posek, arguably one of the most important posekim in modern history. And that Rav Moshe Feinstein was the Rav's mother's cousin. So I guess that means it was the Rabbi Feinstein was the Rav's first cousin once removed. So they were closely related. So that's an important fact that people need to know as well. It's fascinating just to think about also the difference between the Soloveitchik family and the Feinstein family. They talk about how the Soloveitchik family were very serious learners. They were more of the Lithuanian approach, kind of just, I don't want to use the word cold, but I'll just use the word cold just to help form a picture. Just, you know, we sit and we learn it, and we keep halacha. The Feinstein family was known to be a little bit more warmer, so it's fascinating about the Rav. We spoke about how Rav Kook was so impacted by both his mother's and his father's legacy, right? The kind of like the Litvak and the Hasidish. So similarly, the Rav was impacted by his father, who was more of the Lithuanian world, and his mother, who was again, you know, from the Feinstein family, so still obviously serious Torah learners, but more of like a warmth perspective towards Judaism and not just a black and white, let's just sit and learn. So it's important to note that as well. So what's really interesting also about the Rav is that you don't find that he did so many things in the first 40 or so years of his life. So in 1909, that was when he was 6 years old, his father became a rabbi in Rosieni in Lithuania. Then in 1913, his father again moved the whole family to Chaslovitz, which was in White Russia. There was a large community of Lubavitchers actually that was there that his father was the rabbi of, and so clearly then the Rav became close with in some of his most formative years with a Lubavitch community. It's actually fascinating. We'll see in a minute what happened in the Rav's education. You could imagine you have this very Litvak family from the Volozhina name, the Brisker methodology, and they're going to be with a bunch of Lubavitchers. How there's already some tension that might begin to spur there. But they were there, this family, for 8 years. Take a look at source number two. So when the Rav was being educated in his early life, so as we mentioned just a moment ago, there was this clear reality that it was going to be that one of his rebbeim would be for sure a Lubavitch person. And so take a look inside in source number two on page three. So this is from one of the articles written by Rabbi Rakevet, who's a Talmud of the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik's early years.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Did he teach
Rabbi Rakevet?
I think I had
him. He's taught in a lot of different places. A lot of people here should know the name from somewhere or other. But now he's living in Israel. He's been there for a number of years, but he's well known in the YU world.
He's been there.
So take a look inside. We'll just read it very quickly. So the young Joseph Soloveitchik spent his formative years in Chaslovitz. Here at the local cheder, he came under the influence of a malamid, Reb Baruch Reisberg, who was a Lubavitcher chassid. That year, the young Soloveitchik learned more about the Tanya, the focal classic of Chabad Hasidic literature, than about the Talmud, which obviously, again, for the Brisker family, is not going to go over so well. The influence of this gifted teacher and the study of the Tanya were to remain with the Rav for decades to come. And introduced the youngster to the disciplines of Hasidic thought, philosophy, and theology. This period in his life was thus described by his son-in-law, Aaron Lichtenstein. Please turn the page. For the better part of a year, young Soloveitchik's Talmudic progress was impeded while the study of Tanya, accompanied by enthralling stories of Hasidic lore, proceeded merrily apace. While Rav Moshe was somewhat slow to detect the true, that's his father, to detect the true state of affairs, his wife, herself the learned daughter of an outstanding rabbinic scholar, was more perceptive. Detecting the slow rate of growth in her son's Talmudic knowledge, she prodded Rav Moshe to remedy the situation. Failing to obtain proper satisfaction, she finally complained to Rav Chaim, right, that would be Rav Moshe's father, and upon the family's next visit to Brisk, the budding scholar was duly examined and found wanting. The result was that Rav Chaim recommended that Rav Moshe henceforth take personal charge of his son's Talmudic education, and it was from that day that the period of rigorous mutual study dated. So the Rav did not go to too many classical schools in his lifetime. He spent a large amount of time learning with his father after this moment. So let's keep reading. We'll see how much he learned with his father. With his father, the young Soloveitchik studied the following Talmudic tractates, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, etc. You could read the list for yourselves. But he obviously learned a lot with his father. During these studies, the youngster developed innovative approaches and novella to explain difficult Talmudic and Maimonidean passages. Rav Moshe later sent a notebook of these insights to his father, Reb Chaim. The latter was overwhelmed with his grandson's precocious abilities and predicted that he would be a major source for Torah illumination for the next generation. Obviously, somewhat prophetic words. The well-known rabbi of Kovno and the author of Dvar Avraham, Reb Avraham Dobner Kahana Shapiro, was later to write, the spirit of his illustrious grandfather, the leading rabbi of his time, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, rests upon Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik. Just like his grandfather, he also is a master of the entire range of Talmudic literature. Happy is the country that will be privileged to be the home of this great sage. The sages have ordained him to be the true interpreter of all religious problems, and the halacha shall always be in accordance with his ruling. So it's quite clear that from the very beginning, even though we'll see that for the Rav still does not become a household name for a number of years after this, his early years, he was just an absolute genius. Based on the genes of his early family from both sides, he was an absolute Eloi. He knew so much. He was just able to understand so much. And based on his understanding, he was then even able to learn Torah, learn Gemara in a way that was just not so common. And so because of his incredible ability, his incredible knowledge, he at a young age was very clearly set to become someone great, and we see that obviously he takes his incredible ability to understand and learn Torah and teach Torah to many great levels, but again not for many years after this. So when he was still young, he learned with his father, and then he also kind of learned on his own enough to kind of get what would be the equivalent of a high school degree nowadays, but that was all basically through homeschooling, tutors, and things like that. Again, never really going to a secular school. In 1924, the Rebbe was still living with his parents, and he decided to attend the Free Polish University. This was his first real secular studies experience. Again, obviously, this is not the classic move for a person coming from the brisker line to now go to university, but that's what he did. And then in 1926, when the Rav was 23 years old, the Rav starts his famed experience of going to the University of Berlin. We'll see the University of Berlin was a really important experience for the Rav, in particular because that is where he got his PhD, in something that, again, you don't not find the classic brisker family going for a PhD in any in any sort of category, but we'll see what he studied, which is in particular fascinating. Also, this happens to be the place where the Rav very famously met the Rebbe, and there's a lot of discourse discussing how well he knew Rabbi Schneerson and how strong their connection was, but this for sure was the place where they met for the first time. You had two huge rabbinic sages that were meeting in their early life. Obviously, there must have been some sort of connection, but not exactly clear what it was, but this was where they met. So the Rav, when he was in the University of Berlin, he majored in philosophy, was particularly interested in what was called the Neo-Kantian school of thought. Not really in the time right now to go through what all that means, but that's what he was interested in. It was sort of a resurgence of the Kantian philosopher of his thought. The Rav, during this time, also in 1926, 1927, he spent time in one of the Berlin rabbinical seminaries, spent time with Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. That's where he spent a number of a serious amount of time learning during this time period. Learned in particular a lot about German Orthodoxy. Right, German Orthodoxy was the first form of Orthodoxy to say that we believe in Torah and something else. Right, Torah uderech eretz is a term that probably many of us are familiar with. So that term started with the German Orthodox world, and in theory, it could be a precursor for this idea of Torah Umada that we have in YU. The problem with that is that the Rav never really used the phrase Torah Umada, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But again, that was the beginning of the Rav getting this perception of the fact that there was Torah and maybe something else that could be valuable. Obviously, nothing is as valuable as Torah, but something else that could go along with it. In his time when he was there in yeshiva, so the Rav became very close with a man by the name of Rabbi Chaim Heller, who becomes a really important person in his life. After that, in 1931, when the Rav was about 28 years old, he married Tanya Lewitt, obviously became Tanya Soloveitchik. She was also an incredibly smart woman in her own right. She earned a PhD in Jena University. They were married. Their Masada Kedushin was Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grichitsky from Vilna. And we'll spend some time speaking about this as well, but his connection and relationship with his wife was absolutely incredible. It's known by many that...
Do you know how they met?
I don't know exactly how they met. That's a good question. I'm not so sure. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. But I'm not... It's... underrated how hard it is to find out information about the Rav's life just by Googling. But if you do Google it and you find it, please let me know. But they got married in this year, and it's well known about their love story. It was really incredible. They loved each other so much. When the Rav lost his wife a number of years later at her young age in her 60s, it was an incredibly devastating part of the Rav's life. He also lost his mother and his brother at the same time period, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But their love was incredible. So in 1932, that's when the Rav formally receives his doctorate. He studied Herman Cohen's epistemology and metaphysics. That was his topic. Take a look at source number 3 to get a better sense of this. Again, we won't spend too much time on what he actually studied, but source number 3 on page 5 will give you a little bit of a taste of it. In 1926, at the age of 23, the Rav commenced his studies at the University of Berlin. Here he majored in philosophy and was attracted to the neo-Kantian school. The Rav formally received his doctorate in 1932 after the acceptance of his dissertation on Herman Cohen's epistemology and metaphysics. The latter was a German Jewish philosopher who taught at the University of Marburg. Cohen brought about a new interpretation of Kant's philosophy, which came to be known as the Marburg School of Neo-Kantianism. Cohen stressed the supremacy of the mathematical and scientific, especially the physical, interpretation of reality. The Rav retained an interest in mathematics and physics during the ensuing decades and utilized this approach in many of his philosophical lectures and writings. The Rav's dissertation was entitled, you could read that in German if you want, I'll read it in English, The Source of Pure Knowledge and the Foundations of Reality in the Philosophical System of Herman Cohen. Not exactly a light table reading, but that is what he wrote his dissertation on. Let's take a look at the last paragraph, which is interesting, kind of being in that mindset that this is a little weird that the Rav is studying something that is not classical Torah thought, and he is one of the great Torah sages of our generation. So originally the topic that the Rav wished to write his doctoral dissertation on was Maimonides and Plato, right? Maimonides is another, of course, very famous rabbi in Jewish history, the Rambam, and his connection and his knowledge of other philosophers was incredibly important. So the Rav wanted to study the Maimonides' relationship with Plato, but its thesis was to have been that general Maimonidean scholarship had erred in seeing Maimonides as a confirmed Aristotelian. However, since there was no one in the university's Department of Philosophy qualified to supervise such a thesis, it never went beyond the planning stages. So that's what the Rav wanted to study, but he never got the opportunity to study that. Moving forward, in 1932, after he formally received his dissertation, he and his wife and their one child decided to move to America. That's where his family had already moved to. His father was already in New York teaching in YU at that point. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of YU at that point. But the Rav and his wife and child did not move to New York. They moved to Boston, where the Rav would set down roots there and be there for the rest of his life. Right? Very famously, he never actually lived in New York. He would shuttle back and forth to New York for all those years that he was teaching there. So he moved to Boston in this year. He was installed as the chief rabbi of Boston on December 11th of 1932. What's interesting also is that when the Rav was there, you know, when you think of the Rav and how much of an impact he made, you don't think of him as being kind of like a basic shul rabbi, but he wasn't, right? He was the rabbi of the city, not in particular of a specific shul, but he really found himself dealing with a lot of the classical community and shul politics that you would find, again, from our looking back, it looks a little bit like pathetic. Like, how could you make the Rav deal with these mundane topics? But that's what he spent his time doing, because, again, he was not the Rav at that point. And he probably himself would not even appreciate the fact that we would make such a statement, because he always viewed all these things, all matters of Jewish life, to be valuable and important to be involved in, not just learning Torah. So the Rav became the chief rabbi of Boston in this time. He provided regular spiritual and communal leadership like any other regular chief rabbi would. He dealt with a lot of politics and a lot of difficulties in the community. In particular, he was famous for having dealt with a lot of the kashrus issues that were there in Boston, and he really took these issues head on. It did not go so well for him, because what happened was there were a number of things that he tried to change. In particular, he tried to help the shochtim, the people who were slaughtering the animals. He tried to help them earn a little bit more money, because he saw that they were not really making so much money. That did not go well. He was accused of laundering money in his own right. He was actually taken to court in 1941. After having been taken to court for tax evasion and other terrible accusations, he was the case was thrown out by the judge, saying that this is absolutely ridiculous, that there's no one who is more pious than this man. And so the judge kind of saw right through the court case, realizing that it was some sort of it was trying to muddy up his name, because people, if you have to pay the shochtim, or that means the wealthy people have to, you know, lose more money to pay them. So it was clearly brought to trial from these people. The judge, immediately realizing this, threw the case out, but the Rav had to deal with this for a number of years. Again, he moved to Boston in 1932, and the case was in 1941. So this was going on for a number of years that he had to deal with a lot of these problems. It's fascinating to note that when the Rav first got to America, when he first got to Boston, he had this very public face. That's not how the Rav is remembered. It's kind of not known so well. We obviously know the Rav very well, but when the Rav was alive and teaching in yeshiva, he did not have the most public face. He was not out giving speeches every other day. 9 times out of 10, you would find the Rav in the classroom teaching his Talmidim. That's where he wanted to be. There's a lot to say for the fact that after this whole event, being so involved in the public light and being taken to court with this large mess over here, that he decided to take a step back from dealing with communal politics and dealing with communal judgments, and really just wanted to focus on learning Torah. So after this point in 1941, he really decided to just take a step back, and he just wanted to teach Torah. That's what he wanted to do, and that's really what he did. For most of his life, he just wound up teaching Torah. 1941 is a really important year, but let's just go back for a second, because we kind of just gave a quick synopsis of his time in Boston, but there were a few things that we did miss. So in 1935, that's when the Rav took his first and only visit to the land of Israel. He was a candidate for to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv at that point. He very famously gave a shiur in Merkaz HaRav. He met Rav Kook once. Rav Kook died right around that time, if you remember. So he only got a chance to meet him just for a moment, but he gave a shiur there. It was a very meaningful shiur, because obviously Rav Kook was also connected to Volozhin. And so now when the Rav was coming to give a shiur in Merkaz HaRav, it was a very special moment. And there are a number of people who wrote about how special the moment was and how incredible his Torah knowledge was, even at that young age of his. Ultimately, the Rav did not receive the position to be the chief rabbi. You can imagine how different the world would have been if the Rav would have moved to Israel at that point and become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and not had stayed in YU. But he was not offered the position. It was given to a rabbi by the name of Moshe Avigdor Amiel of Belgium. He's the one who became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and not the Rav. The Rav went back to America in 1937. He founded the famous Maimonides School in Boston, still a very well-known school and flourishing school in Boston nowadays for the modern Orthodox community there. It was an important move in the Rav's teaching history, because of the fact that Boston, if you will, kind of was where he tried some things out, and then he later would take some of these things to New York. So one thing in particular that he brought to Boston was that he included Talmud in the girls' education, that they would learn Gemara. That was not a very accepted thing to do back then, and even nowadays some people are not so fond of it. Obviously much more accepted, but really back then it was totally not heard of, and the fact that he did that really was the precursor for the fact that he would give the Talmud shiur at Stern many years later. But this was when he did it in 1937, when he started the school. After that, that brings us back to 1940, 1941. So 1941 was a really important year for Yeshiva University, which was then, of course, known as Yeshiva College. The university became in 1945. But in 41, in 1940, Dr. Bernard Revel, who was then the president of YU, he passed away in December. And then in January, the Rav's father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, passed away in the end of January of 1941. So in the course of 2 months, the major leadership of Yeshiva University, again, then Yeshiva College, had passed away, and they needed a replacement for both the president and the Rosh Yeshiva. So who was going to take both of these positions? So there is a lot of conversation about who was going to take what. Did they really want the Rav to take over anything? The Rav was not treated very well when it was assumed by some that he would take over as the Rosh Yeshiva. He met a lot of conflict from the leadership in YU, and even from some of the Talmidim in YU, which we'll see right now. So take a look at source number 4. Source number four was written, it's a book that was written by one of the Rav's sisters, and we'll read through some of it, maybe all of it. It's just fascinating kind of to, again, look back and see how much the Rav was challenged in his early years from becoming a part of YU, and then to see what would happen all these years later. But take a look at source number four on page six. So again, this is his sister writing. She writes, "Death often levels stressful situations, but not at yeshiva college. On the contrary, my father's sudden death added more turmoil at the highest levels of the institution. Now, two outstanding leaders had to be chosen, a new president to lead the school in the right direction, and a Talmudic sage as a successor to father. Before the Shiva week of mourning had ended, reports reached us of a negative campaign being conducted against Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik by the Provisional Committee in charge of Yeshiva College Affairs." Remember also that this was the same year that the Rav was being brought to trial right back in Boston. So you can imagine that did not look so good for him as well. They felt threatened by the breadth of his knowledge. My mother, determined to see her son in his father's place at the yeshiva, began a course of action. First, she tried to approach the problem through official avenues. She called upon Dr. Pinchas Shergin, dean of the Teachers Institute and an important member of the search committee, to submit an application on behalf of her son, Joseph B. Soloveitchik, for his father's position. Right, when you think of the Rav and all the incredible impact that he made on modern Judaism nowadays, you don't think of the fact that this all started with his mother writing a letter to the dean, right? she says, I know, she said, "of your devotion to Yeshiva College. I trust that you are aware that there is no better candidate for my husband's position than my son. Dr. Shergin was noncommittal. I don't know. It's not up to me," he said. And with that, he turned the conversation to my mother's poor health. Determined to achieve her goal, mother contacted the Agudas HaRabbanim, which informed her that the rabbinical board, aware of the false gossip circulating at Yeshiva, has already sent a letter to Samuel Levy, the chairman of the board of directors of Yeshiva, demanding the appointment of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik as senior Rosh Yeshiva, if the board of directors is interested in the yeshiva's future as a great citadel of Talmudic scholarship." Skip below a few paragraphs that begins with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So Lubavitcher Rebbe, so this is not the one that we all know, but it was the one that came before. The Grand Rabbi Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson declared his support for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Again, that's also fascinating, the fact that this Rebbe was pro the Rav taking over NYU. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein of the West Side Institutional Synagogue, professor of homiletics at Yeshiva, and a member of the board of directors, also fought for the candidacy of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Several articles, this is really interesting, against Rabbi Soloveitchik appeared in the Yeshiva College student publication, The Commentator. This is a YU newspaper that those of us who were in YU know about. Even to this day, it still causes a lot of trouble for a lot of people, so this is an old history that it has. However, neither the board of directors nor the temporary administration of the Yeshiva could ignore a rabbinical decree issued by the Agudas HaRabbanim, right? If the Agudas HaRabbanim, an important rabbinic group back then, said that the Rav was an important person to take over, then of course you have to listen to it. Finally, after months of delay, the board contrived a disrespectful plan to offer Rabbi Soloveitchik his father's position only for 1 year, during which time he was to prove his usefulness to the institution. There was still another stipulation. Rabbi Soloveitchik must waive his right of chazakah, right? The fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik was assumed to be the natural successor. He said he would have to waive that and say, "I don't actually get this position if I don't deserve it." It was an unsophisticated plan to humiliate Rabbi Soloveitchik in his quest for his father's position. Rabbi Herbert Goldstein was delegated to inform Rabbi Soloveitchik of the board's decision. It was an unpleasant task. Nevertheless, Rabbi Goldstein met with Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was amazed at the equanimity and serenity with which Rabbi Soloveitchik agreed to the board's absurd proposal. "If I cannot be useful to the yeshiva," he said, "the cradle of Talmud scholarship in the United States, following my father's methodology, I would not want to stay there." Incredibly humble position of the Rav. Again, he wasn't the Rav back then, but the fact that he was able to say, meet such anger and people not wanting him to be there, but just saying, "Okay, you know what, if you don't want me to be there, that's all right." What happened? Well, his first year in April of 1941, 2 weeks after Pesach, exceeded all expectations, even of his advocates, and silenced his antagonists forever. Rabbis, teachers, faculty members, and students who attended Rabbi Soloveitchik's first lecture testified to the originality and clarity of his interpretations of difficult Talmudic problems, which had troubled scholars for many decades. Combining the scientific and analytical approach to Talmudic law introduced by his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, and his only teacher, his father, Reb Moshe, with Agada and mysticism, Rabbi Soloveitchik added a new dimension to the Jewish theology. Really, after this moment, it became clear that the Rav would be the successor of his father. But again, you see how not so simple it was at the beginning. Take a look at source number five for a second, if you want to get a sense exactly of what was going on. So this is from a book called Thinking Aloud. So just as a just to kind of explain what the Book of Thinking Aloud is, in case you're not familiar with it. It's a very controversial book. It's a book that's put together of transcripts from a person by the name of David Holzer. He was a Talmud of the Rav, and he had many conversations with the Rav, so he decided to put in a book a lot of different conversations that he and the Rav had, just actual transcripts of the conversations. Now, very famously, the Soloveitchik family was probably not such a fan of this, because again, he wasn't actually giving, you know, major decisions over here, he was just having a conversation with his Talmud. So it is slightly controversial that this all was published, but nonetheless, there are some fascinating things in there. So take a look at source number 5 on page 8. So this was a conversation that they had about him becoming the Rosh Yeshiva in NYU. When I came to Yeshiva University, they gave me an agreement for 1 year. My salary was $20 a week, which is $80 a month, $1,000 a year. That's how much the Rev got paid by YU in his first year. At that time, it wasn't so much from stinginess as from a desire to discourage me so that I should leave. And then the DH is David Holzer, his student, speaking to him. I'm really surprised. There were other forces in the yeshiva. And the Rav says back, there was a transition. Let's not fool ourselves. Running the yeshiva as a makom Torah has different meanings to different people. I thought, since your father had come here, it was natural. The Rav says back, it wasn't so natural. At that time, Dr. Belkin was involved, including people who are dead by now, who were still while alive. They wanted to secularize the institution completely. They wanted to have a Rosh Yeshiva to inspire the Talmidim. Nothing more. It was nothing personal. They considered me a good malamid, right, a good teacher. They just wanted the yeshiva to become a rabbinic seminary, etc. We don't have to read further. Feel free to take a look yourself. But what's really fascinating is that if you're at all in on the hack of current YU politics, is that nothing has changed. There are still these conflicting forces in the YU world. Some people who want to see the yeshiva become more of like a college, you know, like a secular place where any quote-unquote normal person could go, not just some guy who wants to learn. And there are people who say, no, this is a makom Torah. This is the yeshiva that has its heritage going back all the way back to Volozhin. This is one of the most important yeshivas in the world. So this is clearly just an incredibly important makom Torah for American and really world Orthodox Judaism. So that tension still exists very much so today, but the Rav, he had to deal with it way back in the beginning, and so that's how a lot of that's how his career got started in YU. What is so fascinating is that something that you don't really hear about so much is that when the Rav first started LYU. So again, we said there were two positions that needed to be filled, the Rosh Yeshiva position and the presidency. So at first, the Rav was actually very much so considered for the presidency. Eric, can you imagine if he would have been the president of YU and not the Rosh Yeshiva of YU? But that's really what started. So take a look at source number 6 on page 11.
Rabbi, when did this book come out?
Which book?
The book, source
Thinking
5.
Aloud? I don't know exactly when it came out. Not so long ago. It was obviously in the past 25 years since the Rav had passed away.
Footnote adjusts his salary for $2,007, so I'm guessing somewhere around 2007. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
If you look at the bottom of
it.
Okay, so take a look at source number 6 on page 11. So this is a book, two-volume book written by Rabbi Rakefet again, where he goes through a major biography of the Rav. Not the most all-encompassing biography. It's actually fascinating to note that there is very little out there in terms of a single book to turn to get a full sense of the Rav in his life. There's not like a book that starts with his birth and goes through his regular events until he passes away. There are essays and you know, articles written on it, but not full books, which is really interesting. But this book is as close as we do get to it. So take a look at this source. Start from the beginning of that paragraph over there that says the candidacy of the Rav to succeed at Rabbi Revel as the president of the yeshiva had been proposed immediately after the leader's death. Right, that was a very clear candidacy to some back then. His supporters felt that the most qualified candidate for Dr. Revel's position was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who was recognized not only as the world's greatest Talmudic sage, but also as an outstanding scholar in general philosophy, right? Something that we didn't spend an incredible amount of time discussing and fleshing out, but obviously the Rav's knowledge of Torah was matched by his knowledge of the secular world, right? When he was a young boy, there are stories told of his mother teaching him literature and these incredible writers from back in the day that he became familiarized with. And then, of course, when he got his PhD in the most clearly Jewish topic, he was an incredible sign of just of knowledge of secular knowledge as well. So that was always the model of the presidency for YU, someone who could bridge secular knowledge knowledge and Torah knowledge. So in many ways, there you could see the original thought and say maybe he should just be the president instead. So with the death of Rav Moshe, the Rav was now also the most obvious claimant to succeed his father, right? Again, the president passed away about a month before his father. So at first when he passed away, they said, oh, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik should be the president, and his father will be the Rosh Yeshiva in tandem. It'll be beautiful. Then when his father passed away, that's when things got a little more complicated. Let's keep going a little bit further. Nevertheless, some of Yeshiva's administrators, board members and students opposed his selection. In their eyes, the Rav was identified with the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. This was a group that was later to become part of the RCA. This organization was made up of European trained rabbis, and its public image was constantly marred by their endless controversies in the area of kashrut supervision. Moreover, there was some fear that the Union of Orthodox Rabbis would try to gain control of the yeshiva and its rabbinical graduates. Very often, the English-speaking yeshiva rabbis were viewed as rivals and upstarts by their older Yiddish-speaking colleagues. We mentioned before that the commentator played a part in all this. An editorial in the commentator, the YU paper, declared that the driving force behind the appointment of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik as the leadership of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, is no surprise. The record of anarchy and kashrus and the dire danger of a barren future to Torah true Judaism are eloquent testimony to the hegemony of the Agudas HaRabbanim in America Orthodox life. Right, so not really the most positive things were written about him. Nonetheless, I just because of time, I think we'll stop reading this source. But again, when the Rav started in YU, it was not met with ease, and this conflict that he had to deal with was great, but obviously he did become the Rosh Yeshiva NYU. One of my teachers, who actually just coincidentally I quoted over Shabbos as well, Rabbi Carmi, once taught a class in NYU, probably still teaches the class in NYU, and entitled The Philosophy of the Rav. And one of the stories that he told over, which is fascinating, is that everyone wants to know in NYU, nowadays, modern 2019 NYU, you come in, so how many Rosh Yeshiva does NYU have? I don't know, like 27, right? Every single rabbi is called Rosh Yeshiva. Where does that come from? So Rabbi Carmi said that this actually all started when Rabbi Soloveitchik came to YU. He was seen as such a powerful force that if he would be the Rosh Yeshiva of YU, he would totally take over the entire place. So what do? They said every rabbi who gives a magid shir, he is now a Rosh Yeshiva, limiting the Rav's power. Obviously, it didn't work so well. The Rav still became the Rav, and he was still the most well-known Rosh Yeshiva from YU, probably of all time. But that's where it all started. Why is every person in YU named Rosh Yeshiva? Because of this moment when he became the Rosh Yeshiva, they wanted to try to limit his power, to dilute his power a little bit. So that's where how it all started. Okay, take a breath. You're doing well?
Yeah.
Okay. Obviously, when he took this position in YU, he still decided to keep his position back in Boston. That's where his family lived. Like we said, he would shuttle back and forth every single week. He teaches in YU for the next 44 years until 1985. He passes, again, a few years later in 93, but he teaches just until he was able to teach, until he was able to keep the strength with him. So there are a few important passages that I think are just worthwhile to read to get a sense of how important teaching was for the Rav and how much he was appreciated by his Talmidim, by his students, as being such an incredible teacher. Everyone knew it was an amazing historical event. Every single time he spoke or he gave a shir, it was just amazing. And to this day, I was in Rabbi Willig's shir for a number of years in YU, who was a Talmud of the Rav in his later years. And you hear him talk about his Rebbe, and it's as if his Rebbe is still so alive and present in his heart, and this is a person who passed away 25 years ago. You know, the fact that he was able to make such an impact goes all the way back to the fact that, first and foremost, the Rav was just a Rebbe. He was a teacher to students, and let's see a few sources that talk about how incredible the Rav was in the classroom. So, take a look at page number 14. It's the beginning of source number 7. The bottom, the second to last paragraph that begins in the early decades. So in the early decades of his teaching, the Rav was very demanding in his classroom and could be severely critical of students who did not utilize their full ability. We'll note, by the way, that after his wife passed away, the Rav's style of teaching drastically changed. We'll speak about that in a few minutes. But at the beginning, he was like a tiger. With the passage of time, he gradually mellowed and became much more tolerant of a student's shortcomings. One of the Rav's students in this period later wrote about his classroom experiences to have heard his Talmudic lectures for 3 years in a class of some 20 rabbinical students is to have seen a gaon at work. His discourses ran to about 3 hours without pause. Nowadays, giving a shir in YU for more than an hour is like heresy, the fact that you can give a shir for so long, but the Rav would give a shir for 3 hours. No one fidgeted or budged. He was absolutely riveting. To follow his argument was to be caught up in an intellectual adventure that accelerated one's pulse beat, one's attention, could not stray for an instant, or he would be lost for the balance of the Rav's shear. We had no time for note-taking, so mortgaged was our concentration on the intricate and interconnected pattern of the Rav's presentation. Immediately after he was done, we would all get together in a corner of the base medrash to pool our conceptions of what was said and to fill each other in on what might have been missed or miscomprehended. These were magical times for us students of the Rav. A sense of triumph pervaded us when, after hours of discussion, we thought we had finally got it right. They just loved the Rav. There was not a single Talmud that you hear of that was not enamored when he would speak, when he would teach. It was just amazing. And the fact that it wasn't always so clear to them, not because the Rav didn't give it over clearly, but because it was such high-level learning. This was the same Torah, right? Generations later, that the Gra would teach over to his students. Essentially, it's the same line of Talmudic scholarship, and that's what the Rav was giving over to his students, and they felt it. They knew they were in the presence of greatness when he was teaching. But what about, now turn the page, take a look at page 16 for a second. One more quick passage. So very famously, the Rav, we're going to start in the middle of the page that starts a yeshiva university student. So the Rav very famously would give yurtzeit shiurim at first for his father, who had passed away, the first for these shiurim, and later on for his wife and for his mother as well. And over here, you have a student describing what one of his yurtzeit drushas in the 1950s, again, for his father, what it was like. So, let's just begin with the quote. It is the evening of the third of Shvat, the yurtzeit of the Rav's father, of Moshe Zatzal, and we are in Lampart Auditorium at Yeshiva University awaiting the arrival of the Rav to deliver his annual yurtzeit shiur. The rooms back then, they were packed. That there was only standing room only in these rooms. And those of you who know Lampard Auditorium, it's a very large room. Some of us have been sitting for a few hours, having come early to obtain seats as close as possible to the Rav. The auditorium is now packed and overflowing. Suddenly, as if an electric current has run through the room, the entire audience as one rises because the Rav has arrived. Sitting in front, we do not immediately see the Rav, for he enters from the rear and must traverse the entire length of the auditorium to reach us. Everyone is standing, blocking our view, yet the feeling of his presence pervades the room. Finally, the Rav emerges from the crowd, walking briskly, manuscript in hand, steps onto the stage and sits down behind an empty table to begin the shiur. Then the journey starts. The Rav, usually focusing on one or more halachos of Rambam, ticks off one question after another that reflects obvious difficulties in the halacha. At least they are obvious after the Rav sets them out in his clear, lucid, and inimitable manner of exposition. Then, after developing each of his questions, superlative pedagogue that he is, he views in summary form all of them to assure that we understand what the problems are that will now be clarified. So you can keep reading, but it's just amazing the descriptions that the Talmidim, that his students had of his teaching style. It was incredible. There's no other word just to sum it up other than the fact that it was an amazing experience for everyone and everyone felt it. But what we don't talk about so much is, what about the Rav's perspective, right? Everyone knew it was amazing to be in the Rav's presence, but how did the Rav see his responsibility of teaching his students? So take a look at source number 8 on page 19. This is just one small passage that talks about it. We just don't have time to go into it too much more, but this is the Rav quoted speaking at a Shavuot Brachos of one of his students. So he says as follows, "I have the privilege of teaching two of the children of the father of the groom. My relationship with them can be expressed in the following sentence. They are my pupils and also my pals." Right? This is Rabbi Salvechik speaking. "Really, we joke together in the classroom. I become young. When I enter the classroom, my youth returns to me. The other day, I visited the doctor and he examined me. So finally, he asked me, 'What is your age?' I told him, 'Doctor, it depends. Where? In your office, 120. In my classroom, 20. I like being around young boys and I become one of the gang. That is the only way to teach. A teacher who does not lose years in the classroom and does not become one of his class cannot teach Torah successfully. You teach pals and friends. You do not teach anything to anyone who is below you. This is my philosophy of teaching Torah." Right? The Rav's perspective as a teacher was felt by his students. Not only did they just appreciate the sheer Torah knowledge that he had, but just the perspective that he had in being a teacher. He was not some superior person in his mind, right? He was just one of their friends, just teaching over a chabura, if you will, to all of his hundreds of closest friends. He was just
And yet, aren't there so many stories about his Talmidim, some of them like petrified that they were going to be called on, pointed out in class, that they would hide behind a pillar, like hoping that they could hide.
So it's very funny. I've heard firsthand stories of what you're talking about as well. So first just take note of the fact that this was given, he said this in 1977. 1977 was 10 years after his wife and he had all those losses. So I don't think his perception changed. I think he always viewed it like this, but his style had changed and maybe made him more of like a, you know, like a soft puppy instead of like a strong lion. And because of the fact that again, we'll speak about it in just a moment, why that he was so impacted. But I think that became clearer as time went on, that he wasn't as rough. But yeah, in the beginning, earlier on, he was he really was. It was I'll tell you
what. We heard Rabbi Lamb speak of him in that tone.
Yeah.
You know, telling stories about like
my Rebbe was one of his main talmidim for years. Rabbi Fulda.
Yeah.
He just spoke in awe. Of being in his class.
Okay, so I'll tell you one story, just because you're making me say it. So Rabbi Willig once told over the following story. He said in his first year, again, these are he started in the Rav Shir in 66 before he had all these losses. So when he started there, he said his first semester in this year, he was terrified. Everyone said, you know, just don't make eye contact with him. Right. No matter what, just don't make eye contact. So the entire semester, Rabbi Willig speaking, said he kept his face down. Whenever the Rav would look up, he looked down at his desk. And he would avoid making eye contact. And then finally, what happened? So Rabbi Willig is a very, very smart man. So at the end of the semester, Rabbi Willig got the highest mark on the test. He got 106 on the Bechina or something like that. Rav Schechter was grading the Bechinas back then. He was the Shir assistant. So all of a sudden, the beginning of the next semester, the Rav feels a little foolish. He doesn't know his own Talmud, who did the best in the entire class. So all of a sudden, this is the way Rabbi Willig tells the story. The Rav, in his strong accent, he starts the first class of the next semester. He looks around the room. Willig, where are you? That's how Rabbi Willig tells over the story, because the Rav just couldn't understand how he cannot know one of his Talmidim. And the way Rabbi Willig tells the story is that after that, I was not free and clear anymore. I was in the hot seat all the time. But yeah, people were terrified of Ashir, because he had these expectations of his students to such a great level that he wasn't trying to put anyone on the spot. He would just call on you and say, why don't you know everything by heart that I just taught to you? And again, it wasn't out of a high expectation and a love for his students, and not out of like, you know, like a cruelty. So, but yeah, certainly not out of embarrassment, but inevitably that does seem to have happened a number of times. So for the rest of the Rav's life, after him starting at YU, he was an incredibly important teacher to many. For the remaining 15 minutes or so that we have, which it's going to be interesting how we're going to try to do this, but in the remaining 15 minutes or so, what I want to do is sort of try to sum up the Rav's thought and his writings. And by that, I mean that there's no way humanly possible for us to ever fully sum up every single teaching that he ever had. But the Rav has a few very famous pieces that are well known nowadays, and I thought it would be worthwhile just to go through a few of them together. Now, what's fascinating is that we're not going to go through any of his Gemara shears or any of his proper shirim that he has given over, which arguably, even if you would ask the Rav himself, probably would be more important to teach over when you want us to talk about his legacy than some of his other major writings. But nonetheless, I think just for ease, maybe at some other point in time we can talk. Thank you. We do, you know, we quote the Rav's Torah on a regular basis, both in Shirim and Drushas. But in terms of giving over some more of his thoughts, so that's what I want to do for the remaining few minutes that we have today. So the Rav, very famously, did not publish very much in his early life, and a lot of that comes from the fact that the Rav did not really believe in publishing. His father also never published, his grandfather also never published, and the reason why was because they all come from this Brisker methodology that learning is never finished. And if learning is never finished, how can I ever publish something as if it's complete? It's impossible. It needs to be perfect, and really, nothing is ever really perfect. So that's why they publish so little. The Rav, as time goes on, he does publish a little bit more, and posthumously, there have been so many things published in the name of the Rav, but in his own lifetime, he did not publish very much. So the first thing the Rav published was the famous Isha Halacha, otherwise known as Halachic Man. It started off being published in Hebrew in a journal called Talpiot, that was in 1944. It was translated into English only about 39 years later in 1983. But just out of curiosity, have people here read Halachic Man? By a raise of hands?
What else?
Okay, not so many. So good. So I'm glad we're doing this. Wait, Debbie, were you going to say something?
No, I read something.
Okay, well, so just an interesting story that I do feel the need to share also. I asked my Rebbe at another point, Rabbi Willig, why it is that if you read through some of the Rav's writings, they are impossible to understand some of them. The language and so many different parts of it are literally, if you, it's not a light read, right? You're not going to sit, curl up in your bed on Shabbos. I've done it before, but you're probably not going to crawl up in your bed on Shabbos with a nice cup of hot tea and a piece from the Rav, because you need to be sitting with like a light shining on you to understand what the Rav is talking about in some of his writings. And so I once asked my Rebbe why it is that his writings are so hard to understand. And so what Rabbi Willig said was that the full question was, why are they so hard to understand when the Rav was known as such a masterful teacher? So they're not given over so coherently, it would seem. So Rabbi Willig, the way he said it was that if you look at some of his writings nowadays, the philosophical writings, that was not meant to be an eternal teaching. Those are meant to be for the generation, right? Back in certainly when the Rav was writing these things, philosophy was much more important. Nowadays, philosophy is not as valued by the public as much as it was back then. Theological discussions, they just don't happen as much nowadays. And as a result, his Torah teachings, his straight-out Torah teachings, those are eternal. But these other philosophical teachings are not as eternal, so therefore that's why they may be a little bit more complicated to understand. Nonetheless, I think you can argue, just based on hearing stories about the Rav teaching in his Gemara here, it sounds like those were not so simple anyways. But regardless, I just thought I would preface with that story. So the Rav writes Halachic Man in 44, again translated in 1983. So what's so just cool, frankly, about the Rav's writings is that, and what made him such a powerful figure was that he took the Brisker methodology, which for those of us who don't know, the Brisker methodology in a nutshell is the idea of Tzvei Dinim. Right, the idea that there's always two sides of the coin. Right, there are always two perspectives to view something, and it's a very interesting perspective. Right, that means when you look at a person, well, if you look at him from this angle or you look at him from that angle, you're going to see an entirely different person. So that's how all of the Rav's writings, just about, I'm not a master by any stretch of the imagination in all of his writings, but most of his writings, you'll open them up, you'll see how there are two perspectives. There's the X and the Z. There is the A and the B. There is the right and the left. There are two sides that sort of meet, but are not the same at all. So what am I actually talking about? So take a look at source number 9. So in Halachic Man, he opens up with this idea. So he says that Halachic Man, we'll read a little bit and then we'll try to explain as much as we can. Halachic Man, page 22, reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. On the one hand, he is as far removed from homo religiosus as East is from West, and is identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. On the other hand, he is a man of God, possessor of an ontological approach that is devoted to God, and of a worldview saturated with the radiance of the divine presence. Okay, so we're not going to read any further just because of time, but just to spell out all these characters. So the Rav says as follows, there are two perspectives of a man, and then there is a third category of this person called halachic man. So there is the cognitive man, who is a man who is totally immersed sort of in the sciences, if you will. That's how he views the world. Everything as a scientific method. Then there's homo religiosus, who just wants to spend his time understanding theology and deal with the cosmos and spirituality. And these are very polar opposites in terms of their perspectives of the world, right? There is the scientific and then the religious. And then halachic man, in his mind, is sort of the fusion of those two. This person who, on the one hand, is a deeply religious person, but halachic in that he needs to see the world through sort of like a scientific method, right? If he wants to measure a mikvah, so he can't use the spiritual side of him, he needs to use the scientific side of him. If he wants to view any halachic question in the world, he will need to view the scientific part of him to sort of cognitively understand it, and he can't be in the clouds all the time. So halachic man is the fusion of these two different people, and it's a really important essay. It's not so long, again, it is not so easy to read, but I do recommend it at some point in life to pick it up. I have a copy right here. You see this little blue book? You've seen it before? It's a really fascinating read, but that is what he's saying in a nutshell of a nutshell. And the question really becomes, is who is halachic man, right? Is this the paradigm that we're all supposed to live up to, or is he talking about a specific person? So there seems to be some sort of a divergence over what he was talking about over here, of if he was giving a sort of like a biography, or if he was of one of his predecessors, or if he was speaking about himself, or again, the paradigm. So I do bring some sources that talk about it, but we'll just say it outside. So some people seem to be saying that, who is he talking about with halachic man? Well, he's talking about his grandfather, this is, or even his father, right? The great people from his legacy, who from his heritage, who were able to match a care and understanding of the world at large, but also able to understand the great spiritual depths of what the Torah and a relationship with God has to offer, fuse it all together and master the halacha in a way that no one else has been able to do before. In particular, he has one story that he shares in the, this essay in Halachic Man, where he talks about his grandfather who used to, and I think about this every single Yom Kippur, who he talks about his grandfather looking out the window at the ending of Yom Kippur, and he's seeing the sun set, and he remembers his grandfather saying, as the sun was setting, I am watching the Day of Atonement leaving me. In other words, when his father, when his grandfather, Halachic Man, at the paradigm of Halachic Man, when he saw the sun setting, he didn't see the sun as a star setting on planet Earth. All he saw was the halachic reality that was before him, and that was the day of Yom Kippur was being completed. That's just how he viewed the world. Everywhere he looked, it was how does the halacha talk about this, and not how does the science, or even the spiritual aspects, not always, how do they relate to it? Just the black and white halacha, the sun setting on Yom Kippur means that the Day of Atonement is coming to a close. That is it. So that is, according to some, that when the Rebbe was referring to Halachic Man, maybe he was simply talking about his grandfather. Though, if you take a look at the English translator of Halachic Man, his name was Lawrence Kaplan. He writes in his page 26. He writes in his preface to this. Just take a look. Let's see. It's 2, 4, 6. About 10 lines from the bottom on page 26, where the line starts off with the words, and above all. He says, and above all, he's giving his thank yous, and above all, my own teacher, the halachic man par excellence of our generation, Rabbi Joseph B. Salvechik. So the Rav would obviously never refer to himself as halachic man, but obviously it was something that he valued and wanted to be like. So Lawrence Kaplan over here, who was writing the translation of this, he calls the Rav a halachic man, because again, that's how the Rav also saw the world. He saw the world in a halachic construct, viewing everything as this is how the halacha sees X, Y, and Z. So that is Halachic Man in a nutshell, and again, a really important piece from the Rav, and this is the paradigm of how he wrote everything else. There are always these two perspectives. There is the cognitive man, there is the homo religiosus, and then there is the middle, there is the fusion in between those two things. So we'll quickly try to do a little bit more, but I know we only really have a few more minutes here. So in 1946, the Rav became the head of the Religious Zionists of America, which is formerly known as Mizrahi. He becomes the head of this group. Obviously, like everything in life, in particular with the Rav, it's heavily debated how to view him. Was he really a Zionist? Did he really support the land of Israel? Up to what point did he support the Medina? So it's debated by his students to this day. But he, nonetheless, you can't deny the fact that he was the head of the Religious Zionists of America. And he gave a famous speech, which was then later published into a book known as Kol Dodi Do Fake, which he talks about, spells out what he refers to as the six knocks, proof that we are so close to the Mashiach coming, to the final redemption coming, because of these six knocks, as he outlines, based on the pasuk of Kol Dodi Do Fake, that my love, my beloved, is knocking, from the pasuk in Shir HaShirim. He outlines the fact that there are six clear signs of the fact that the redemption is so near. And feel free to take a look at source number 12. I just copied a lot of that chapter over there, which he outlines them. But again, we do not have the time to discuss it right now. A few years after this, between the years of 1950 and 1960, the Rav served as a rabbi, believe it or not, on the Upper West Side of a congregation, Moriah. He served as a rabbi there for 10 years. How does that work exactly? I'm not entirely sure. I assume he was not really there for Shabbos so often, because he also was a rabbi back in Boston and a rabbi at
Wayne. I think.
Right, exactly. Oh, good. So he gave a weekly shir. But is that all he did? I'm not sure. All right, so he gave a famed weekly shir there. Thank you, Rabbi Volk, for bringing that up. He gave a famed weekly shir there it was an incredible opportunity for people in the New York area, because everyone heard about him from YU, everyone heard about him from Boston, but other people in New York, unless you were in YU, you couldn't appreciate his Torah. Obviously, they didn't have YU Torah and things like that back in the day to hear his shirim. So hundreds would gather for his shir, for his weekly shir that he used to give back in the shul. It was open to the public, and anyone came, and people who had been hearing about Rabbi Soloveitchik for so many years finally had the opportunity to hear and learn from him. So that was for 10 years between 1950 and 1960. In 1965, the Rav published his arguably, according to some of his students, his most famous writing, and that is The Lonely Man of Faith, right? That's over here. A lot of people have heard of that. Who has read that? Is that curious? Ah, okay, good. A few more people have read The Lonely Man of Faith. So The Lonely Man of Faith, in a nutshell, talks about the fact that the Rav, he himself always viewed himself as a lonely person, and in particular, he says, why am I such a lonely person? Not because I don't have friends or family, thank God he had lots of friends and family, but because of how he viewed the world. He divides the world based on the first few chapters of Bereishis, how it talks about there are two forms of creation. There is the first creation, which is Adam 1, and the second creation, which is Adam 2. Adam 1 in creation is sort of this magnificent version of mankind, the man who can do anything he wants to do. He is the one who takes issue with the cosmos and fights with the cosmos. He is incredible, magnificent, he could accomplish anything. Then there is Adam 2, who is not necessarily as powerful and as strong as Adam 1, but he makes the choice not to be. He says, you know what, I am not such a big shot. I will simply just, instead of creating the garden, I will work the garden. That's one of the analogies, I believe, that he gives. And in particular, he says with Adam 2, but really even arguably, I would say with Adam 1, there's a sort of existential loneliness that comes along with the fact that at the end of the day, you're all alone in this world, right? You're either Adam 1 or you're Adam 2, or you're both, but all we are is that just by ourselves, we are nothing. We're just this lonely person, unless you have a relationship with God. And God is the solution to solving loneliness in this world. We feel lonely because at the end of the day, when you go to sleep at night, even if you're going to sleep next to someone or you're not going to sleep next to someone, you are in your own body, you are alone, unless you have this relationship with God. And that's what the Rav argues in The Lonely Man of Faith. And it's, again, one of his most important essays that he wrote, again, according to some of his students, one of the most well-known. Like we said, 2 years after this, in 1967, it was an incredibly, incredibly difficult year for the Rav. He lost three of his family members, his mother and his wife, of course, and his brother, Dr. Shmuel Soloveitchik. Dr. Shmuel Soloveitchik was actually a chemistry professor in NYU for a few years. But he ended up passing away relatively early, so this was a very difficult year for the Rav. My Rebbe, Rabbi Willett, talks about how he was actually in Karen Biavna that year in 1967, and when he came back, first of all, it was difficult to be away from his Rebbe when this was all happening, but when he came back, he could see that the Rav had changed. Everyone spoke about it. His son, many years later, after his father had passed away, he spoke about how his father just changed. That year was so impactful to him, obviously, in a very sad way, that his entire tone of teaching and everything changed. But nonetheless, what everyone agreed to is the fact that he still kept going, right? He lost three people over the course of 3 months, and some people would just stop, quit, and give up on life. But the Rav kept going. He still kept everything. He didn't really stop anything. He just kept teaching Torah, which is what he always loved doing. Again, we just because of time, we don't really have time to talk about it, but sources number 14 and 15 talk about his love and his respect for his mother, and of course his love and his dedication to his wife. But so feel free to take a look at that on your own time. In 1977, 10 years later, the Rav gave the famed big shiur where he gave the first Talmud shiur in Stern College. This was on October 11th, and of course, this was a very important moment because, you know, when you're in Boston, you could do whatever you want. When you're in New York in Yeshiva University, to give a Talmud shiur for women, that was a huge statement that the Rav made. To this day, is it debated why he did it? Why would he even think to do this? Was it b'dieved? Right? Was it not ideal, or was it lechachila? Was it ideal? Still, people are unclear about that, but that is nonetheless what he did. And the descriptions you could read, you go online, you can Google articles about this day. It was a very special day for many people. After that, in 1978, there was an issue of Tradition that published many of his few of his speeches and a few of his very famed essays. Just because of time, we just don't have time to go into all of them, but I would be remiss if I didn't actually mention the names of some of these essays. So he wrote some famous essays or gave some famous speeches: Confrontation, Catharsis, The Community, Majesty and Humility. These are some of the names. Feel free to take a look afterwards, where again, he analyzes the world or people or personalities from two different perspectives, always with this Brisker methodology of you can look at it this way or you can look at it that way. That's always how he tended to view things. In the final years, his health began to wean. He said he stopped teaching at YU, but he taught up until the last minute that he had strength. He passed away on April 9th of 1993, or the 18th of Nisan, 5773. We'll finish in just 60 seconds, but it's worthwhile to spend just a few minutes, and I think we'll just take a look at the sources very quickly, sources number 16 and 17, just to get a sense of how much the world has changed its perception of the Rav. Right? So when the Rav was alive and well, the world was a certain way, viewed the Rav a certain way, but how much that has actually changed. So take a look at source number 16 on page 50. There's an article written by Hillel Goldberg, Rabbi Volk, entitled The Posthumous Life of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He outlines a few major shifts that the world has made since 26 years ago, since he has passed away. Number one, you see the numbers over there? So number one who has come to study the Rav's writings since his death would never guess that during his lifetime it was often noted that his influence stemmed from his classroom lectures, not from his published writings. So we spent a few moments discussing the Lonely Man of Faith, Halachic Man. During the Rav's lifetime, he wasn't really known for these pieces as much as he was known for his teaching in the classroom. Nonetheless, that's just how it has developed. He is more probably well known now for his writing of Lonely Man of Faith than any of his Gemara teachings. Whether or not the Rav would have liked that, that's up for debate, but it's just the reality, according to this author. Number two, the opposition to the Rav in the right-wing Orthodox circles during his lifetime was sharp and often personal, based primarily on his embrace of the study of the Western philosophy and of the institution. Yeshiva University that validated this type of study, much of that opposition has declined, right? Back in the day, it used to be there were people who used to refer to the Rav as the Rav, my Rebbe, an incredible, incredibly important rabbi of our generation. And then there were the right-wing group who would call him JB, right? Sort of for Joseph B. Soloveitchik. So very clearly trying to denigrate him, and that's you refer to JB, you refer to a friend as JB, to some bum as JB, not to the Rav. But that's how they viewed him again. But he's saying it's true, it doesn't really exist anymore nowadays. Number three, the Rav, who never called himself a modern Orthodox Jew, as we said, and rarely, if ever, used the term, has been reframed as the father of modern Orthodoxy. Right? It's ironic. My Rebbe, again, Rabbi Willig, said that his Rebbe, the Rav, never used the phrase Torah Umada ever. But nonetheless, that is, the Rav is the father of modern Orthodoxy, and as the most important figure in Yeshiva University's history, and one of the main builders of Yeshiva University, is framed as the halachic decider and the philosophical decider of the institution. But again, modern Orthodoxy and Torah Umada are not phrases or terms that the Rav himself used. Number four, was the Rav a Zionist? So skip down a few lines. The answer is among disciples very widely. He certainly was a supporter of Israel. Obviously, he never got back to Israel after that first visit that he had back in 35, but he was clearly a lover of Israel and believed very deeply in the value of having land. To what extent that would exist, right? What camp would he be in? That's up for debate. But nonetheless, he was clearly a great lover of the land of Israel. Turn the page to right below the paragraph that starts with number five, that begins above all these matters. Above all these matters, what strikes me most about the Rav's legacy is how deeply he has penetrated the lives and minds of so many people, both of those who knew him and those who did not. While it is true that his lectures were well attended, the number of people who have gained from the Rav since his death dwarfed the number of people who knew him from Shear or from Boston. This Lonely Man of Faith has created an enormous informal community of students that would, I suspect, surprise even him. From New York to Zurich, from Jerusalem to Santa Fe, from English readers to readers in Hebrew, Spanish, and many other languages, the name Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik needs no introduction. The current signs indicate that the impact of this Gadol Batar will only continue to grow. Right? What's so fascinating is that nowadays, he is so well known. Back in his day, if you would have asked him, the Rav famously always would refer to himself as a Malamed. I'm a teacher, that's all I am. But the impact that he is said to have had nowadays, and every year it just grows even more and more, it's incredible. And as this author is saying, he's probably right, that every single year probably will continue to grow more. And why is that? Probably it's also just because of technology, right? You see how much Rabbi Soloveitchik is spread on YU Torah and things like that, and how his name is spread. You know, they just completed the Rav's Chumash earlier this year, and you saw that we had an event in YU of about, I think, 300 some odd people just to come to celebrate this monumental event. The fact that the Rav is making such an impact day in and day out, more so probably now than he might have in the past, just speaks to how incredible the Rav was as a person and how important his having him as our Rebbe, as the Rav, was for our Jewish heritage. One final source, which we won't read inside, but we'll just say outside. What's so powerful and fascinating about the Rav is the fact that so many leaders in the modern Orthodox world, and more to the right and more to the left, claim that the Rav is their Rebbe. You have someone like David Hartman, who is a very, very left-wing, probably, I mean, not to say on tape, but hard to argue that he was still within the Orthodox fold. You have people from the Chovave world, right, Avi Weiss, who view him very much as their Rebbe. Again, not for right now, certainly not in a public forum. But then you have people all the way on the right, right? Rav Schechter, people say Rav Schechter is a, Rav Schechter is probably his moderate Talmud, right? He is probably the most centrist in many extents of his Talmud. And then he has people like Rav Ilson, you know, who are living in Israel, and even more to the right, and then more center. Right? You have a son, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who he's probably the most centrist of all of them. But just the wide breadth of Talmidim that he had, that he produced, and that he continues to produce, by the way. He still has new Talmidim that pop up nowadays because of the fact that they get a hold of his teachings, and they become a Talmud, they become a student of his. But that all speaks to the greatness of who the Rav was, that he was a master of Talmud and Torah, and unmatched by anyone, but he was also a master of so many topics and issues of the secular world that no matter who you were, you felt connected to him because he could talk about anything. And because of that greatness that, you know, in many ways, unfortunately, that caused great confusion for us nowadays because, like we said before, he did not publish as much as you would have maybe liked. And because he didn't publish as much as during his lifetime, then that creates this ability for everyone to say, oh, I know who the Rav is. I know who the Rav was. So that does create some confusion. But nonetheless, it all also speaks to the greatness of who he was. The fact that he was able to be a teacher to so many, the fact that to this day, every single person in America, you talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's the Rav, he is our Rebbe, he is very much still connected and still alive through his teachings, and it's important that we should all keep remembering him and keep teaching his Torah because it was so valuable. As my Rebbe said, his Torah really was eternal. So that brings us to the end of this class, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you.